Hello and welcome to another episode of the Elastico podcast, and we've got a great show lined up for you this week. Today I'm joined by Rio once more. Hi, Rio.
Hey, Chris.
And also we have Christian Yari from the Bundesliga Fanatic podcast. We have Simon Walsh from the Sunderland fan site Roker Report, who also produces an excellent podcast on his club. And also Gary L. Smith, Twitter's resident African football expert and writer for Supersport. We're grateful to have all of these guys on, and we'll get talking in a minute. We've got a range of topics lined up. First, though, this week's results. Rio, what happened in Brazil this week?
So, Brazil, there was probably the biggest game was Corinthians playing against Flamengo. So, that happened on Wednesday. Corinthians are the current league leaders, and Flamengo, inspired and led by Ronaldinho, are one of the title contenders. So that was a big, big game. And David put Flamengo ahead early on in the game, but Corinthians came back with two goals from former Portuguese international Liedson, who's been a real revelation this season for them. So Corinthians are still in first place in the league. Flamengo have dropped down a few positions. I think they have three losses in a row now, which, you know, they were the team that were undefeated for a long time in the league, but now they really seem to be suffering after their initial first loss.
Well, that's seven games without a win, right, Rio?
Yeah, exactly right. Part of that Ronaldinho has been missing for. He was suspended for a game. He was with the Brazil squad for another game. So some of the sort of excuses are coming that way, but Flamengo's trying to make a statement that they are not just Ronaldinho, but we'll have to see how that goes.
Any other news from Brazil, or was it a fairly bland week this week?
Yeah, overall, São Paulo is still looking very good, and they are currently in third place, I think. The other big news is just how well all the four big clubs from Rio de Janeiro are doing. Vasco, Botafogo, Fluminense, and Flamengo all challenging for those Libertadores positions. So it's a pleasant surprise that so many Rio clubs are doing well, considering usually the league is more dominated by clubs from São Paulo and other parts of the country, and it's unusual for all four to be challenging so well. So we'll see how long that lasts, but that's probably the other biggest talking point right now.
In Germany this week, a similar situation. The team at the top won. That, of course, is Bayern Munich, and they put seven past Freiburg, with Mario Gomez scoring four times. Dortmund, last year's champions, lost 2-1 at home to Hertha Berlin, with a Brazilian, Rafael, scoring there. And Hoffenheim put four past Mainz. Rio, you have action from Italy for us?
I do. So Serie A finally got kicked off this weekend. The first match was a fairly exciting match. It was Milan playing against Lazio. And surprisingly, Lazio went up 2-0 in the first 20 minutes or so, with Klose and Cisse scoring goals in their league debuts for their new clubs. But Milan came back, tied it 2-2, Cassano Ibrahimovic, but that's where it stayed. And after the game was tied, Milan were looking the better side, but no real impetus. And the game sort of lost a bit of its early spark. And beyond that, the big news is probably Juventus doing so well. They had a very busy summer, lots of new players coming in, new coach, new stadium, and they got things started very well for a 4-1 win over Parma. And meanwhile, Napoli also did well, 3-1 away win to Cesena. And probably the biggest disappointing team so far will be Roma, who also had big moves over the summer, a new coach, new players, but they lost 2-1 at home to Cagliari. So that was surprising and continues their disappointing early season form after they were knocked out of Europe.
Right, and in France, it's been interesting once more. Marseille continued their terrible start to the season with a 1-0 loss at home to Rennes. That was a Gio Ecoco goal for Rennes, sealing the victory. Lille came back to secure a 3-1 victory away at Saint-Étienne, with Eden Hazard scoring twice and Joe Cole setting up the third for Obraniak. And also, Lyon won away 2-1 at Dijon, with Bartomeu Gomis scoring and an early own goal and sending them on their way to their win. And also, Paris Saint-Germain are taking on Brest, and it's currently 0-0 with half an hour still to play. Spain, Ria.
Spain definitely had some big news this week, which was the surprising fact that Barcelona did not win a game. They drew 2-2 with Real Sociedad. Meanwhile, Mourinho was I'm sure, very happy because his side won against Getafe 4-2. So Real Madrid are now top of the table, and Barcelona are not. The early fueling of the fire of the season has already started with Barcelona, the first side to slip up in these early days. Meanwhile, Valencia got their second win from two games with a very good 1-0 victory against Atletico Madrid. So Valencia are showing that there is life after all without Juan Mata, while Atletico is showing that life is tough without Sergio Aguero.
Right, and it's been a fantastic week of action in the Premier League as well. No top four clashes this week, but we've had some great action that has kick-started some team seasons, and one example of that would be Arsenal, who secured a 1-0 victory against Swansea after a ridiculous error from Swansea keeper Michael Vorm, who's been on excellent form this season, but he allowed Andre Arshavin to score to secure the Gunners' first win of the season. Manchester City won 3-0 at home to Wigan with a hat-trick from Sergio Aguero, and then that was bettered by Manchester United later on in the day, who put 5 past Bolton away with another hat-trick this time, and once more for Wayne Rooney. Spurs won with goals from Emmanuel Adebayor and Jermaine Defoe, and also Chelsea won 2-1 away at Sunderland. Right, so obviously this weekend there was a full host of Premier League games. We've still got a Monday night game to come. So, Chris, what did you make of this weekend's action?
Well, I thought it was a pretty standard, no real upsets or surprises. I mean, United and City are still steamrolling their opposition. And you have to say, even though it's very early in the season, that these two are the two favorites for the title. But, of course, you know, City are still a team that's developing. And Mancini just brought in a bunch of new players. And they'll have the Champions League to contend with in a pretty difficult group. So we don't know how it's going to turn out, but, I mean, given their squad depth, I think they'll be up there at the end. And, you know, of course, Arsenal probably had the most important win, even though it was against Swansea. It was a win they needed desperately. The new players played, and I thought they did pretty well. Even though it was against a smaller opponent, the real test will come when they're playing the likes of Chelsea and then again City and United. But, yeah, they got 3 important points, and that's, I guess, Wenger is very happy about that.
Gary, I know you follow Arsenal's results very closely. What did you make of their performance this weekend?
I just felt that it was a performance that made Arsenal breathe a huge sigh of relief after everything that had happened in the past week. The 8-2, regardless of what Arsene Wenger is going to tell us, I think was the catalyst for the spending spree before the end of the transfer window. And based on that, whether all the signings are going to work, because obviously Arsenal didn't have a transfer policy, regardless of what Wenger again is going to tell us, whether they are going to work because they were so scattergunned, it's for us to see. But in the game we played with Swansea, you know, there was this creativity that was a bit lacking. The absence of Fabregas and Nashri and all the others was seen. But at the end of the day, it was 3 points. 3 points gotten. And probably it's just the tonic Arsenal need to kickstart the season. Let's see how it goes from now.
For sure. I mean, we're going to look at the Champions League games in a bit. But I think for now, Arsenal definitely just needed to get 3 points under their belt. Simon, I know obviously we're going to talk about Sunderland in a bit more depth later. What have you made of the rest of the league's action this weekend? Is there any result that particularly stood out for you?
Not really, to be honest. I think it was a bit like Chris said. A lot of the results went according to form, and a lot was what we expected. I think one result that stood out for me was Man United again scoring for fun. I think it's going to be very telling come the end of the season. It's going to be a very tight race at the top between themselves, City. Well, who knows? Maybe Chelsea and Liverpool might make a bit of a run of it, but I think goal difference will be very important come the end of the season. And to get these sort of wins in now, 5-0, sorry, Gary, but 8-2, things like that, it's going to pay off. And you just can't stop them at the minute. It's an unbelievable... They're like a machine. And every year somebody says it's the weakest team, the weakest Man United team for years and things like that. And they just constantly go against that. It's almost ridiculous.
Rio, I mean, Chelsea obviously got a good win under their belt this weekend, so I'll let you have your weekly Chelsea report now. How are they progressing? And Man United next week, it's a big game.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think Chelsea, you know, is continuing to improve. That's definitely the theme here, is that every game they look a little bit better, in my opinion. I think Villas-Boas was, you know, showed his sort of confidence in himself by benching Torres. Is kind of a ballsy move, you could call it. But Sturridge coming in, Anelka starting, and I think both, well, especially Sturridge, obviously did very well. And Juan Mata, as I have spoken about before, is looking like a real, real good player. He was just pulling the strings in that midfield. He didn't end up getting an assist for either goal, but he created a lot of opportunities for his teammates, and he probably could have had and should have had a few assists. So certainly I'm impressed with that, but you're right. I fear that the encounter with Man United is coming a bit too early for this Chelsea team, especially since it'll be at Old Trafford. And with the form that United is showing right now, I'm not quite sure Chelsea has improved at the high enough rate. I think they're still a little weak defensively at times, and they're not quite as sharp in front of goal, finishing all the opportunities they create. But it should be a cracking game, I'm sure.
So this week's results seem to have been fairly straightforward thus far, so it gives us the opportunity to explore some topics around the game and also to focus a bit more with Simon coming on Sunderland in a bit. But for now, there's been an interesting topic brought up this week by Oliver Holt of the Daily Mirror. It's been seized upon by other publications, and that's this Rooney Rule, which comes from the NFL in America, where clubs or franchises have to interview at least one black manager or one minority manager for the position of manager or head coach. Rio, you live in America, and Chris, you too, I'll get you in a minute. What do you feel about this rule?
So I like the rule. I think that it has worked quite well in the NFL. I think that's probably the most important thing to point out right away. As soon as the rule was implemented, there was definitely a rise in black managers in the NFL, and they've done very well. And it's not even just head coaches, but also, you know, chairmen of these franchises and, you know, directors and things like that. So I don't see a real harm in it, to be honest, because the rule encourages you or requires you to interview more candidates. It doesn't require you to hire anybody that you don't want to hire. So I don't think anybody would end up hiring a candidate they don't want to hire. They just have more people that they interview and consider for a position. And I don't see how that could go wrong, really.
Chris, so we've got a situation where 25% of the players in the Premier League are black. And yet, in recent time, we've only had Paul Ince and Chris Hughton as black managers. Do you think this is in any way a problem with a inherent racism at the top level, or do you think it's just the wave of black players is more recent and they haven't had time to reach the high levels of coaching yet?
I wouldn't. It's always a bit controversial to generalize or try to sort out or get to the root of these issues. I mean, when it comes to England, I think it's primarily a cultural thing and just a development, societal development over time that's kind of put a hierarchy and a structure in place where it's these white, I suppose, managers or players making it through the ranks because they might have access to the education, the licenses, and that's what they're they've known from beginning to end, and that's what they see. And but I mean, if we see more than two black managers in 92 professional clubs in England, I think that's going to encourage others to have a go at it, and we'll have kind of a spillover effect, the same way it has in the NFL.
Gary, do you think it's as simple as that? Do you think we need more role models, and then it'll bring through the next generation of black head coaches?
Well, the first thing we have to look at is how and why the Rooney Rule worked in the United States. I mean, obviously, there was a sort of dearth of minority coaches in the NFL, which is why the rule came into force in the first place. Now, in the NFL, where you have a lot of the black or the minority, you know, players being of minority extraction, this would work well because there was the interest in the first place. How many black managers in England are willing to become coaches of the Premier League? Fine, if we are able to find them, how many of them are ready in terms of qualifications? How many of them have the requisite know-how to become the boss of Arsenal, of Manchester United, of Everton, or any other Premier League club? If we can find these things, then we are good to go. Is it a case where the FA's regulations and rules are inhibiting black coaches or minority coaches from getting their jobs? If it is so, then I'm all for it. But somewhere in me, I think that there aren't a lot of minority coaches even making the effort, you know, putting in the time and effort to get noticed out there. Let's go to the Championship. Let's go to League One. Let's go to the lower leagues. Are we going to find minority coaches there? If we can find them, then, of course, we can help them make the step up.
Simon, I don't know if you have any view on this. We obviously, people like Paul Ince, they had a very brief shot at it, but they've never had a second chance. Is it a lack of motivation on the part of black players to go into management? They have other areas they wish to pursue, or is it just seen as a very white-dominated area, and that's what the FA is, or the media is pushing for a change in how it's perceived?
I think the Rooney Rule won't make that much difference in the English game. And plus, I don't think it's actually necessary, because I think at all times, I mean, you touched on a rumored racism issue. I can't see that at all. I think in any job, the best person for the job will get the job, regardless of race or anything like that. And it certainly can't be within the FA when they've got the likes of Noel Blake at under 19 level and things like that, who's doing very well. And like you say, Paul Ince had a trance. I don't think it was anything to do with the fact he's black. He just wasn't a particularly good manager and things like that. It's the same. I don't think it adds anything really. I think always the best man, the person the board feels is the best manager, is always going to get the job.
Rio, back to NFL. They brought this in because there was a perceived lack of black coaches at the highest level. And we've now had a recent run where I think it's the majority of the last 15 or so championships have been coached by a black manager. Do you put it down solely to this rule?
To some extent, I think the rule, you know, in the NFL, I think this rule had a much more immediate effect than it could have in the Premier League. You know, the NFL is a much smaller league in the sense of, you know, the Premier League is just part of a global network of leagues. And, you know, the Championship is closely tied to it. La Liga, Serie A, and all other European leagues and world leagues are tied to it just because of the way the market works, because of the way that people move in between these different leagues. The NFL is pretty much the NFL. There are a few other American football leagues in the world, but they don't really come close to comparing. So it's a much smaller family and network. So I think it's easier for this network to sort of prevail in the NFL, in the sense of players that, you know, let's say black players that want to get into coaching, that have a certain history in the game, they are well known by everyone. They don't have to prove themselves in the sense of they know how the league works. So there's perhaps an advantage there that even if they don't have the necessary background coaching-wise, they at least have that sort of fame in the league that will allow them to be given a shot there. So I think it will be more difficult in England because there are so many more coaches and so many more players everywhere. But I think it probably goes back to what Gary said, that you know, if we implement a rule like this, then it could start in League One and League Two and the Championship. You give these young black coaches that don't have very much experience a shot at a lower level, and then they can grow from there and prove themselves. So, like I said, it probably wouldn't have nearly as big of an immediate effect, but I think in the long term, it could very well help out.
Okay, so just finally on the Rooney rule issue, Chris, I know in France there's Colombori at PSG is a very high-profile black coach. Your expertise is obviously in Germany. Has there been any high-profile minority managers in Germany?
Not really, but and certainly not. There is really no demand for it, or it's not really as much a topic in the coaching sense as much as it was in the player sense. But, you know, recently there's been black players who have featured for the national team, like Gerald Asamoah early in the decade and Kakao now. And there was even a black player in the 80s who managed to make an appearance for the national team. So there was a precedent set in Germany that kind of prevented it from being a contentious issue now. But one comment I wanted to make is that the difference between England and the States when it comes to black managers in sports is that there's a distinct, I think, cultural difference in what the sport means to the community. For example, in the States, football, American football and basketball, but American football for the sake of this conversation, is a very, very important part of African-American culture and community. So it's emphasized from a very, very young age, and it's supported and encouraged. So all these players and managers have role models. They're pushed to study, to learn the game, to become familiar with it. So there's kind of a precedence that's set where you have a wide base of resources available to get into management. Whereas in the EPL, I think that's very much lacking, and I think it'll be much, much more difficult to implement, and it might not happen as readily.
Gary or Simon, do you have anything more you wish to add on the topic?
Yeah, Chris, I was reading earlier that in the NFL and in America, just as Christian has enumerated right now, there's the thing about African Americans or blacks having been trained to accept the fact that they can get to the highest level of the game. And because they had been there, they had always been nearly boys, if you like, for so long, people started questioning why they couldn't be the head coaches of teams that they had dominated as players. So they were given the opportunity, and then they delivered. In the Premier League, how many teams in the history of the Premier League have even had assistant coaches? Be it the first assistant coach or the second assistant coach. For the purposes of our discussion right now, probably the biggest example we may have now is Emiliano at Chelsea, you know. But apart from him, I don't see anybody else. And I was reading earlier that the past four Super Bowls in the U.S. have featured four head coaches of color. Two of the past five NFL Coach of the Year award recipients are also head coaches of color. These are people who have earned it. In the Premier League, you don't have anything like that. I mean, I'm all for opening up the admission process and the interviewing process. But the fact of it is that as we speak now, I can't say that there have been lack of opportunities in Premier League clubs where there has been, you know, constant segregation or racism, if you like. I'm yet to see it, but if the Rooney Rule is brought into the Premier League, that's very, very cool. but I'm saying that it might just blow up in our faces. It will certainly encourage a lot of people to take up coaching, but for now, we don't have the materials out there.
Right, so I think we'll leave the Rooney Rule there. It's a very interesting discussion, and obviously if people want to get in touch, we'll broadcast our Twitter accounts at the end and they can carry on the debate online. Next up for discussion, they've been one of the more interesting teams of this early season, Sunderland. So, Simon, I'll let you fill everyone in on how Sunderland have started.
It's been a mixed start, I would say. When we came into the season feeling pretty positive about things, we seemed to have addressed a few needs with the likes of Wes Brown and John O'Shea, Craig Gardner, Sebastian Larsson to a degree, and we thought this is going to be the season that something happens. Started off well enough against Liverpool, ones each, and since then it's been a bit of a false dawn. One thing that has been very good so far is we've done very well defensively, I think, but it's the problems lie in front of goal, where we just can't. We're not creating enough chances. We're not. When we do create chances, we're not taking them. We just can't score. I mean, even the game against Chelsea, I know Ji Dong Won scored at the very end, but that was nothing really, because Chelsea had barely got out of first gear the whole game, and they didn't need to. Just such was our lack of a threat, and obviously with the whole Asamoah Gyan thing, which has kicked off in the last couple of days, it all seems very bizarre. I don't know where things are going, and you do feel that there's something not right behind the scenes. We don't know what, but you do get that impression. So it's been a very mixed start. There's a lot of people calling for the head of Steve Bruce and player X is rubbish, etc. Everyone should be sacked. We should start again, as Sunderland fans are prone to do on the back of any defeat. But you know, we. I think there's something we're not being told at the minute. I don't want to start any particular rumours or anything like that, but there is something not right at the minute.
Well, at this point, I'll bring Gary in, because Gary, you've written quite a lot in the last couple of days, obviously, on Asamoah Gyan, your countryman. He's a big symbol of Ghanaian football at the moment, and now he's off to the UAE. What do you think influenced him to make that decision? Obviously, there's a lot of people saying it's a purely monetary-based decision, but what's your view on it?
$200,000 excess, depending on who you believe, is an amount, a week, I should add, is an amount of money that is guaranteed to turn anybody into a money-grabbing machine, first of all, before you then think about loyalty. But we have to look at the circumstances that came into this deal. And as you know, we just heard, we don't know the full circumstances of the deal. But according to what I know, Asamoah Gyan's head had been turned, as Steve Bruce said in the post-match interview after Sunderland were beaten by Chelsea, that his head had been turned after the England-Ghana game in March. And from the little checks that I have also made, that is correct. Now, as I stated in the piece I wrote explaining why Gyan left, you know, Asamoah Gyan came to Sunderland, he had quite a few offers on the table. But obviously, like every player would, he looked at what Sunderland had to offer in terms of the players they were signing, the players that were there already, and what their ambition was. And of course, who was the boss at the time? Steve Bruce was the boss. They had some pretty good signings. And up front, Asamoah Gyan as a striker was thrilled to be pairing with Darren Bent, who is a prolific goal scorer anywhere he is. Now, Darren Bent suddenly left for reasons that have been well documented in January, but he said it wasn't for monetary reasons. He said it was for football reasons. Sunderland, since then, have not had such a good replacement for Darren Bent, and Asamoah Gyan sort of felt lonely up front. That was first. Now, secondly, after Ghana played England in the Wembley, Asamoah Gyan and his agents went to see the team to get an increase in wages and stuff like that. But Neil Quinn thought it wasn't necessary. He rebuffed it and told them, look, you're only 1 year into your deal. Bang us a couple of more goals and let's see what's going to happen. Asamoah wasn't happy about it. And as we've seen in the past couple of months, he hasn't been himself. Again, just like Steve Bruce said. Now, the offer started coming somewhere in April, June, July, August. This UAE team came quite late into the picture, as it turns out. The teams that were in it strongly from the start were the Turkish ones. Trabzonspor, Galatasaray, and Fenerbahce. Those were the guys in the hunt. But Jan wasn't happy. That is correct enough. And like I stated in the article, he said in Ghana, in the past couple of months, that the motivation at Sunderland wasn't there. And don't forget that in the last 12 games or so that Sunderland played till the end of the Premier League, they had been in extremely poor form. And it also meant that Sunderland, the dressing room in Sunderland was poor, basically, from what Jan told a couple of people down here. And because of that, any sane player would want to leave. However, there's a question that Sunderland fans would ask. If your team is broke, when you came to the team, everything was fine. If there's something in your team that is broke, why don't you fix it? Why would you want to leave? You know, and for me personally, I've not wanted to say this on Twitter, but I think it's good to say it here. Asamoah Gyan had a sort of loyalty to show to Sunderland fans. Because at the end of the day, this is a club that has been in existence for so long. And let's face it, in the history of Sunderland, they have been more clinical, better strikers that have come and played for Sunderland in all these years that the club has been in existence. For Sunderland to take 13 million quid to make you the top striker, I think Asamoah Gyan could do far more in terms of loyalty, you know. And that is where personally I have a problem. Because if there's something wrong with the dressing room, as he said, if Darren Bent had left, if John Mensah had left, if Sule Muntari had left and Anton Ferdinand had left and they were his friends there, I don't think that, you know, you came to the club purposely because of them. You came to Sunderland to make history with them. You came to the club because you wanted to move forward with them. You believed in the goals and ideals of Sunderland Football Club. And I think that's where he made a mistake. On the other hand, the kind of monies that we've heard in the past couple of days are quite unbelievable for a one-year deal. $3 million, some have reported $2.8 million, but $3 million for a one-year loan deal is a lot of money, you know. And on the other hand, let's not forget that this is a player from Africa as well. You know, it's not like in Europe where a lot of players have people coming after them immediately their careers in the Premier League end. Asamoah Gyan is also 25 years. There's a possibility that he could have left the Premier League anyway after 2 or 3 years to go to some other league because, you know, probably either he might have got a dip in form or conversely, he might have been too hot for Sunderland to keep. There are all these possibilities. And for him, he decided that, okay, this is the time that he needed to cash in on such an unbelievable deal. Because coming back to Africa to live here after your career, it's not really easy. You wouldn't have much to do. Asamoah Gyan is educated, you know. He's got high school education. That is where he reached in his career before he stopped his education to focus on his football. And then again, there was a sentimental reason I pointed out in my article. Now, up till, at least what I know, up till last 2 weeks, Asamoah Gyan was in two minds. He wasn't too sure whether to leave Sunderland because he obviously had some affection for the club because of the fans and everything. And then there was also the fact that the other clubs were coming for him, but he was in two minds. And then last week, Saturday, somewhere by this time, the man who discovered him while he was at 13 years here in Ghana passed away. And this is the man, his name is Alhaji Sly Tete. He was the same guy who discovered some of Ghana's current crop of very, very good players like Sule Muntari, like Michael Essien, John Pantel, and a host of other players who have formed the core of Ghana's team in the past 2 or 3 years. The death of this man should not be underestimated because this was the man who actually took Asamoah Gyan from the street. He took him through school, through high school, and he was the same man who made him who he is. He took him to Udinese, just like we see Kojua somewhere also in Udinese. He took Sule Muntari also to Udinese. He took Derek Boateng to Europe for the first time. And he took all these other guys. So they have a lot of allegiance to him. I mean, the death of this man was so profound on the Ghana Football Association that when Ghana played Brazil, there was a minute silence held in his honor, if you remember. The death of this man did a lot to sway Asamoah to leave England. I'm not clear why, but in the next few days, we've been told that he's coming out with his own version of the story. But basically, in summary, he wasn't happy at Sunderland because he felt the club's ambitions had waned from last summer. He felt that the people that the club signed, that the club would have been able to finish at least 8th in the Premier League, were not there. And so he wasn't sure about the ambitions of the club. And he also felt that, you know, things weren't organized at the club. In addition to, of course, the money aspect. When Al Ain or Al Ain came to him and offered him the deal, he first rebuffed it because he also felt that UAE wasn't on level pegging with the Premier League. So initially, and we were told that on several occasions, he told his agent Fabien Pivoteau first that, look, I'm not going. There's nothing I'm going to look for in UAE that Sunderland can give me. But then they kept on bidding more and more. They kept on adding more zeros to the offer, and he couldn't resist it. Let's not forget that Al Ain is owned by royalty of the United Arab Emirates. For them, money is no object. So as far as I know, these were the reasons why Asamoah Gyan left Sunderland. But he said he's going to come out in the next few days with more with his side of the story. But I bet you that these are some of the things that will come out.
Right. So, Simon, hearing that as a Sunderland fan and someone who is so involved in like fan support of the club, what do you make listening to those rumours about your star man who's just left?
I think that is exactly what it was all about, to be honest. When it comes down to it, I think, well, for start off with, just move the fact he's moved to the UAE Pro League is, I find it a ridiculous move at this age. Even if he's not happy and he wants to go, that's fine. He can't say he's gone there for any other reason other than the money. Even if he does come out in a few days' time with apparently his side of the story, it would be ridiculous to suggest it was for anything other than the money. When there was top offers on show. There was, like you say, the Turkish teams. There was also rumoured to have it Atletico Madrid and the likes of that. We don't know how serious those sort of interests were, but if they are serious, and he's only 25 years old, then why not go and test yourself at that level? You'll get, fair enough, you won't get £200,000 a week, but you will get something fairly decent. And that offer in the UAE, I think, would still be there for him when he's 30 years old or whatever, and he's coming towards the twilight years of his career. And he could go over there and make $100,000 a week, $75,000 a week, whatever. It seems to me that money has gone before ambition.
Right, so, Christian, I'll bring you in at this point. You can look at this objectively from an outsider's point of view. Can you blame a player for taking a one-year contract that's going to earn him $3 million with the thought that in 12 months' time he can go back to one of Europe's top leagues and continue playing again?
It's I can see both sides of the argument. I mean, I understand why he left, and I don't blame any player who is at a club with declining ambitions. I mean, Torres left Liverpool for similar reasons, we were told, and I completely understand that, even though he went about it the wrong way. You have to look at the way he grew up. He came from an impoverished background in Africa, and for them, the money aspect is more emphasized than it might be for other players. So you can be ambitious, but when a deal like this comes up, it's very difficult to turn down. But it is disappointing to see a player still in the young stages of his career, do what he did. I mean, had he stayed in Europe and performed well, you know, like we said, the deal would still be there at the end of his career, and he could cash in then. But, you know, it's I think it's telling of him as a as kind of a person where he stands in life that he made this move.
Rio, I'll bring you in, coming from a Brazilian point of view here. Brazil's had a lot of players over the last few years who've been labeled as mercenaries in Brazil for leaving and going to places like Ukraine, Russia, United Arab Emirates, and picking up what Brazilians see as easy money. Where do you stand on this aspect of the game?
So for me, it's I understand, right? And I think anyone can understand if a player wants to go and get some more money somewhere, right? They a footballer's career is a very short one. A bad injury could happen at any moment and curtail your career. And so you can't really blame players when they want to get paid more. I think the difference in what you described in the Brazilian league, these players that tend to go to the Middle East from Brazil, and there's a lot of them right now, they're the type that you really don't see ever making it that big. You know, there are some very good players that go there. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, somebody like Ganso or Neymar, they wouldn't go to the Middle East. They wouldn't take that offer. So the difference in this case, and to me, is that Gian is a fantastic player. He's still relatively young. He has shown that at times he can be a world-class player. So he has that potential. So it like Christian was saying, I think it says something about his personality that he would rather take the short-term gain of making more money with this move rather than do his own career more justice and sticking around what is the best league in the world. If you are an ambitious player and you want to play with the very best and you want to continuously improve, you would not walk away from the Premier League and go to the Middle East. So I think this may very well hurt him in the future, because even if he can come back in a year, the fact that he has shown that he has made this decision will make any other future potential suitors a little bit more hesitant about where his heart really lies.
Simon, coming back to Sunderland then, we'll leave Asamoah Gyan alone until we get some more information from the player. We kind of see the two northeast clubs, Newcastle and Sunderland. They both look to have made some pretty decent signings this summer, but over the course of the last 12 months, they've both let a lot of players go as well, and they're both particularly short now in the striking department. So do you think, we'll focus on Sunderland, do you think that accusation that Sunderland's ambitions aren't living up to what they were 12 months ago is fair, or do you think there's the same level of ambition being shown by the club?
To be honest, that's what I was going to say. I kind of forgot to mention it when you said it at first, but that is something that I feel is a little bit of an unjust accusation from Asamoah Gyan, that we're lacking in ambition. I think we're very ambitious, but unfortunately, we are kind of like hindered by geography and stuff. We couldn't be further from like the glamour lights of London and Manchester and things like that, where there's, you know, plenty to do. It's pretty much just quite a small town with a big passionate football following. So it's very much for football people, which is probably where Asamoah Gyan's face didn't really fit, if you know what I mean. If he is after money over the game, that wouldn't really help. But we have shown ambition, definitely, this season. And as I said, we came into the season very positive, feeling this was a year where we could possibly certainly get in the top 10 and with an outside hope of looking at the Europa League places. And we went ahead and we signed people. I mean, they're not the biggest names in the world, but the likes of Wes Brown and John O'Shea, who've won the Champions League twice, played internationally quite a lot, things like that. We signed some good, solid players. And in comparison to when Asamoah Gyan was here, we've definitely got a better squad on paper now than we did then. So to say there's a lack of ambition, I can't see how that conclusion may have been come to. As far as signings this summer, yeah, we've made a hell of a lot again, and it's almost becoming a problem that we've signed so many players, because last season we signed 10 or 11 players, and we were told at the start of the summer there would only be slight tinkering with the squad, there wouldn't be a great deal going on, we'd just address some needs and carry on. But we've actually went and signed another 10 players. But at the same time as signing 10 players, we've also failed to address the biggest needs, such as basically an entire left-hand side. We don't have a recognised left-back, we don't have a recognised left-winger in the entire squad. And that is going to be a big problem. So whilst we've signed good players, I mean, Larsson, good player, Gardner, he hasn't been in form yet this season, but I'm sure he will be good eventually. Connor Wickham is an exciting prospect, as is Ji-Dong Won. We've spoke about the two Man United lads, but at the same time we failed to address the biggest needs, and that is a big failing of the club.
Right, so just quickly then, to end up on Sunderland, I want a prediction from you on where you're going to finish, and do you think Steve Bruce will last out the season?
I think, putting my head on the line here. I think we come 12th and Steve Bruce doesn't last the season.
Right.
That's a prediction, not necessarily what I want.
which is a crying shame, really, because Steve Bruce is an excellent manager, unfortunately.
I think so too. I think, but his position is under a lot of threat at the minute. It's become one part of the problem at the minute, something we've been discussing a lot on our site, has his position become untenable now? Because he says a lot of things in the press. Like the other day after the match, he's very outspoken about Arsene Wenger. That's fantastic. Well done. You sound like you're being honest and things like that. But we do seem to play the injured party quite a lot. There's moments where, I mean, say, okay, Arsene Wenger wasn't happy. He wanted to leave. It's up to the management to try and address that situation, make him happy, get him back scoring and things like that. Obviously, there's going to be occasions when some people just aren't for turn and they've made their mind up. But as Gary said, he was very much in two minds for a while. And there was an opportunity there to put things right, which instead we passed the buck and let him go. We need to do more about it. If we do have the ambitions that we stated, and we think we are on the right track, we're just making slower progress than most people would like. We need to hang on to these sort of players. We need to do something internally to keep them happy, as opposed to saying, oh well, if you're not happy you can go.
Right.
It's same as like in the summer, like a comparison for me would be, say, Luka Modric, I mean, who wanted very much to go to Chelsea, but Tottenham were adamant it wasn't going to happen, and it didn't happen. Why can't we pull that sort of card?
So you're asking from a stronger standpoint from the chairman and the manager, is it?
Yeah, they need to, well, for lack of better phrasing, grow some balls and do something to keep these people on side.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it with Sunderland, or the management need to grow some balls. Right, we're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll be back with Gary and Christian in particular, discussing first African football and the African Cup of Nations qualifiers, and then the Bundesliga so far. Welcome back, and we've got, obviously, Gary L. Smith here today, and we're just going to have a quick discussion now, Gary, about the African Cup of Nations qualifiers last weekend. What were the big talking points?
Well, obviously, Ivory Coast have already qualified for the next Africa Cup of Nations. The fact that Rwanda also sacked their coach after Ivory Coast beat them 5-0 was one big one. You know, it didn't come as a surprise, really, because one of the aims of Rwanda in hiring the coach, Celestin Tete, into the position was to get them into the African Cup of Nations. He had been able to get them into two regional tournaments, the latter stages of two regional tournaments, but the ultimate goal was to get into the Cup of Nations. And the way in which they had lost, you know, the 5-0, had become a bit difficult for the country. And so he had resigned before he had even been sacked, because information was that he was going to be sacked. So that was basically the headline there. And then you had a team like Zimbabwe, you know, with all their economic troubles, still looking like they can very much get into the Cup of Nations. They won 3-0 against Liberia. And then there was the good story, the feel-good story, if you like, of Libya. Despite all their political troubles as well, they also won 1-0 against Mozambique. I also did a piece this week on ESPN SoccerNet about it, you know, about the fact that Libya's national team are finding themselves in a new wave of patriotism because of the fact that the team is getting into... most of the team, I must say, have aligned their allegiance to the national... the Transitional Council. The Transitional Council, who used to be the rebel faction. And so it means that they are playing for more than national pride now. They are playing for something else. And this could be the first time that Libya goes into the African Cup of Nations without anything at all. Colonel Gaddafi, we know, has had a hold on the national team, and indeed every facet of Libyan life. And the fact that they are free to play without the shackles of Colonel Gaddafi has been a very big story for them as well. You know, another good story was Nigeria and the way they went into their game against Madagascar. Before they left Nigeria, there had been issues about the way that the Madagascar pitch looked. And so the national goalkeeper, Vincent Nyama, who plays as a second goalkeeper at Lille in France, had led a player revolt. You know, he wanted to influence the players not to fly out of Nigeria to Madagascar. But his coach didn't want to have any of it. Samson Siasia has been known as a disciplinarian since the time that he was admitted as the coach of Nigeria. And he put his feet down. And even though Enyama is a key component of the team and he has been number one for some time now, he had been fantastic during the World Cup, if you remember, especially in the game against Argentina. You know, all that... He put that aside and dropped Enyama. It turned out to be a good decision because it communicated to the players that nobody is bigger than the national team. Earlier this year, he had also dealt Odemwingie, the West Brom player, a very, very big disciplinary blow because Odemwingie felt that he could throw his weight about. But Enyama put his feet down and banned him from the team until he apologized. So that's also been one other story in the Cup of Nations. Apart from that, you know, everything has been this way and that way, the same old, same old. And then I was coming to the North African countries, obviously. Morocco, looking like they will go into the next African Cup of Nations. They have an exciting team I can't wait to see. You know, some of the best of the Moroccan team are in some of the best leagues in Europe, from goalkeeper right down to attack, you know. And then there's Egypt, the high-profile absence of Egypt. Egypt sort of crashed out of the Nations Cup qualifiers two match days ago. And so this time, because they knew they weren't going to qualify anyway, they fielded their under-23 team in the game they were playing. And predictably, they didn't do well. But because of the fact that Egypt were also led by a dictator, you know, for so long, it meant that there wasn't any good transition between the old team and the new team. And they weren't prepared to sort of see off the old guard and slowly replace them with the current crop of players. And this has shown in the way that their team has been dismal. So they are now starting rebuilding, and it's looking like an experiment that's going to be fascinating. Of course, Senegal, we know all about them. I know all about them. Senegal look like they are going to be a big, big team in the next African Cup of Nations. Their attacking lineup is frightening. They have Mamadou Niang in there. They have Papi Cisse, who is banging in the goals for Freiburg in Germany. They have David Doe, who is not in exactly what you call a big league in Scandinavia. but he was one of the top scorers in his league as well. And then they have Demba Ba, obviously, and all around the field, from goalkeeper to defense, they have some of the best talent in some of Europe's best leagues as well. So that's been the story. Cameroon also have also crashed out of the African Cup of Nations. There will be no Samuel Eto'o in the next African Nations Cup.
So if I have to push you right now, Gary, who's going to win the Cup of Nations?
Well, between now and the Cup of Nations, there are a few peculiarities in there because, you know, there are going to be a few European leagues that are going to give their players trouble. And as we see every time, we are going to see the late arrivals of one or two players to their teams. That may affect the balance of certain teams. You know, that's the first thing. But Senegal are looking like favorites already. You have teams like Cote d'Ivoire who are perennial favorites. Nigeria are looking very, very good indeed. You know, the coach is doing well to make some previously unknown names with the established order in the Nigerian hierarchy. And then we have the dark horses, you know. I don't know how South Africa are going to feel about me calling them the dark horses, but based on recent performances in the African Cup of Nations, I think it's best if we call them the dark horse. They look like they are going to do well in the next African Cup. Probably they might not go past the quarterfinal, but in the current state of things, they will do well. And then, guess what? There's Niger. Niger have been building their national team for the last 4 years quietly, and they have a very, very solid team. Burkina Faso as well are a team to watch. Why don't I mention Ghana, you ask? Because we are not really sure what Ghana is looking like, especially with our top striker going to the UAE.
Well, thanks for your roundup there, Gary. I think we obviously always Ghana the best of luck, and hope your side do well in the tournament.
Yeah, why not?
So, Christian, we've obviously brought you in for a bit of your expertise here. What's the story of the Bundesliga so far?
Well, there have been some surprises, as there are every season in the league, and there's been some much-expected results. Bayern are topping the league now. They've looked really, really good. The new coach, Jupp Heynckes, came in. He shored up the defense, and now they've kept... They kept four clean sheets in the first five matches. They've had the third best start ever in their Bundesliga history. They've only conceded a single goal all season long so far. The goal difference is 15. It's above and beyond what most of the other teams in the league have. So for most people watching the league now, they think it's going to be Bayern running away with the league again this year, which tends to happen in Germany. When Bayern have an off year, they rebuild, they spend money during the summer. Then the next year they come back and they win the league in dominant fashion. And many are hoping for Dortmund to challenge Bayern since they did so well last year. But it's been a bit of a struggle for them, to be honest. They've only won two of their five matches, and they've been missing their first-choice striker, Lucas Barrios. And whenever he's out, the team squanders a bunch of chances, and they really, really need him on the pitch to finish. Now they're also missing Mario Götze, who is their primary playmaker now. He's suspended for two matches due to a red card. And it's looking like they're going to be missing Sahin, who left for Madrid, a lot more than people thought. There's a big, big gap in midfield, and it's been very, very noticeable all season long.
And what if Hamburg? We discussed them preseason with Nicholas. They look to be amassing what people thought was a fairly decent team, but they're really struggling.
They are, and I mean, to be fair, they're undergoing their biggest overhaul in club history. I mean, they're restructuring the team from top to bottom. They brought in Arnesen, who was at Chelsea. He's trying to change the entire structure of the club, from the youth levels all the way up, implementing a new style and system of play. Of course, he brought in a bunch of Chelsea's reserve players, and he lowered the wages of the club. He's trying to get them to play a whole different game, and that's never going to be an easy transition. And I mean, they're really, really suffering now. They've looked hapless. They've conceded 16 goals in five matches and are just not rounding into form at all. And their coach, Erning, might not be around for much longer. I think he might have one more game to prove himself, and if not, they're going to continue with a different coach. And I think it's going to be a struggle for Hamburg, to be honest. They're the only team that has never been relegated from the Bundesliga in its over 40 years since its establishment. And I think this season they're going to be fighting relegation.
Right, so on the podcast, obviously, we've discussed the Champions League a lot over the past few weeks. But while you're here, it's best we talk about the two German teams who are in action against British opposition this week. So we've got Dortmund playing Arsenal and Chelsea host Leverkusen. What's your insight on those two games? Do you think Leverkusen can challenge Chelsea? But also for Dortmund, although they're not in great form themselves, it must be a good time to play Arsenal.
Yeah, I think to start with Arsenal and Dortmund, I think Arsenal are the exact type of team they'll be looking to play now in their kind of fluctuating form. Arsenal are a team that tries to play football. You know, we all know their quick passing style of play, and Dortmund are very similar. And, you know, Dortmund have struggled against sides that have kind of bunkered and are sturdy defensively, like Hertha was at the weekend, which they lost against. And, you know, Arsenal play a more open game. And I think that's going to play into the hands of Dortmund. So I think a win is very, very realistic for them, especially since they're playing at home and they've only lost two games at home in the last 19 matches or so. So I think it's definitely doable for Dortmund, especially, you know, considering how poor Arsenal have been. But, I mean, you can't underestimate the experience of Arsenal. They're still a much more experienced side than Dortmund in the competition. So you can't take that for granted, but it's doable for Dortmund. Their chances are definitely higher than Leverkusen, who I don't think stand a chance against Chelsea. And I'm saying that giving Leverkusen a lot of credit. I think they've been doing very, very well in the last 3 years, and they've just been improving as a team. And I think they've been doing well even this season after losing their manager to Bayern, Jupp Heynckes. But I think Chelsea's a too high a proposition for them at the moment.
As we've had a good discussion on all topics today, and we're overrunning a bit, I think we're going to skip the Player of the Week section for this week. Sorry, guys. But instead, we'll finish with a little game at this point and get you all involved. And I'll make a note of your predictions for these two games. And we'll crown the winner after the end of the Champions League ties. So I just want a score prediction on Dortmund against Arsenal and Chelsea against Leverkusen. I'll start with Simon.
Okay, I'm going to go Dortmund 2, Arsenal 0, and Chelsea 1, Leverkusen 0.
Okay, and Gary?
Arsenal 2-2 Dortmund, and Chelsea 3-1 Leverkusen.
Okay, and at this point then, Chris?
I'm going to say Dortmund beat Arsenal 2-1, and Chelsea beat Leverkusen 2-0.
Rio?
I'll go with 1-1 Dortmund-Arsenal and 3-1 Chelsea-Leverkusen.
Right. My only care is beating Rio, so I'm going to go with an Arsenal win, as none of you have done that. So I'm going to say 2-1 Arsenal, and then Chelsea-Leverkusen is going to be 2-0 in my book. Right, it's been a great show. I'd like to thank Simon, that's Simon Walsh of the Roker Report website, for his time. Also Christian Yari from Bundesliga Fanatic, and Gary L. Smith, a freelance writer who works for Supersport on African football. You've also had myself, Christopher Atkins, and Rio once more. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all next week.